Hey, Trojan fans, it's time to get into the huddle with the Peristyle Podcast. The Peristyle Podcast is your weekly ticket to USC football and recruiting news. Don't forget, you can download the podcast 24/7 on our website, peristylepodcast.com. And now, here is the host of the Peristyle Podcast, USCFootball.com publisher, Ryan Abraham.
Hello, Trojan fans, and welcome to episode number 223 of the Peristyle Podcast. Today is May 28th, 2012. Happy Memorial Day to everyone out there in Peristyle Podcast land. We got a great show for you, even on the holiday, for the Peristyle Podcast. We've got Dan Weber coming up a little bit later on in the show, talking some USC football, going to answer all of your questions. We have Coach Harvey Hyde here in the first segment. Bunch of questions to get to, some interesting topics people want to know about this USC Trojan football team. We do love to hear from you. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us podcast@uscfootball.com or you call 206-888-6755, leave a voicemail, and we will play it on the podcast. You can also go to peristylepodcast.com, our website for the Peristyle Podcast, on the left side of the page. Click on leave a voice message. You can do it right from your computer. Well, wanted to jump into it. We have Coach Harvey Hyde coming all the way from vacation land over in Catalina Island. It's a beautiful day over there for Memorial Day. It's going to be fun, but he's still taking some time out to talk some USC football on the Peristyle Podcast. We really appreciate it, Coach. How you doing?
Ryan, thank you very much, and happy Memorial Day weekend to everyone out there. Have a safe one, and it is a beautiful day here in Avalon. And whatever you're planning on doing today, barbecuing or whatever, have a great, safe day. And I'll tell you what, whenever you have a chance to talk football, Ryan, I'm ready. So let's get started.
I love it. All right, we'll get into it. And before we jump right into the USC football topics, I wanted to give a thanks to our sponsor, Southern California Tickets. If you go to sctickets.com, you need tickets for anything. No more Lakers, no more Clippers, but the Kings are still at it, so if you want to get some Kings tickets, obviously the Dodgers are hot. The Angels, I think, have won six in a row now, so lots of sporting choices here in Southern California. If you want tickets for sports, if you want to go to the theater or a concert, something like that, you can go to sctickets.com. They've been nice enough to help us out over the last several years, and I hope you can check them out, and they can help you with your ticket needs. And Coach, I wanted to say thank you, and happy Memorial Day to you on this special day. I know you're taking some time out here of your busy vacation time over there in Catalina, but we weren't sure if we wanted to do the show today, but I think it's a nice little honor for the fallen Trojans of years past, and people still want to talk about some USC football, so we thought we'd do a show.
I agree with you 100%. When we talked about it, I said we got to do it. It's part of what we do. It's entertainment. We play games on holidays, so why not do a show on a holiday?
Right. We can do the show. We can. That's a small sacrifice for us. But I know we want to let you get back to the end of things. So I guess we can jump into some of these questions right away. Let's start. Eric had a question, Coach, a.k.a. Brown Sugar. Hey, Eric, what's up going on, man? He says, do the Trojans have a strong candidate to replace Matt Khalil at left tackle? What do you think about the left tackle spot for USC?
Well, you've got a gifted young player. He's got great potential. He's got great athletic ability. I watch him closely in the spring.
Andre Walker.
Quite a battle. Pardon me?
For Andre Walker.
Andre Walker, yeah. Right. And I think he has the potential to be an All-American. I'm just evaluating him on what I saw. I think he needs to get a little bit more motivated, a little bit tougher. I think he's got to learn to play or turn his motor up a little bit. Got to get out of second gear and get into third gear and not only work hard in as far as during the scrimmages, but work hard in individual technique and warm-ups and stretching and the whole package. He's got to turn into be a leader. On your offensive line, I think your left tackle is a key spot, as we all know, and you've got to depend on him. And he's got to take that responsibility as a left tackle, knowing what his duties are and what his responsibilities are. And if he does what he's supposed to do, the Trojans will have success. And in the future, he may have success in the NFL. But he certainly has the potential. He's big. He's strong. He's lost weight. He's got great quickness. He just needs now to grow up and become a man. And you always hear me talk about that term about shaving. Once he has to shave every day, I think he's going to be a tremendous replacement for Khalil. I really do. He's got great potential. I think they have him at the correct position. And I think he'll do a great job. I think you've got to motivate him and coach him hard. I'd watch him every single play. I mean, you've got to watch all of the positions, don't get me wrong, but I'd assign someone to him, a GA or even the head coach. I'd watch him every play. I wouldn't let him get away with anything, any shortcomings, never loaf, and all of a sudden he'll find out that, well, it's better to do it this way than the other way, and all of a sudden he'll find that it's easier to do it that way, and he'll become a great player.
Do you think it's a positive sign? You mentioned the weight loss. I mean, he lost like 50 pounds or whatever it was. Does that show somewhat motivation that he's able to come in and change his body that dramatically in the first year?
Yeah, I do. I think it's a lot of it's not easy to lose weight, and you have to want to do it. You just can't be told to do it, but you could always sneak snacks in between or do things that, you know, you wouldn't be losing weight. And I think it has a lot to do with your endurance and being able to play a long football game. You can't be overweight and have the endurance that's necessary to play college Division I football. You have to rest when you're carrying extra weight. And getting down to the body size he is, I think it fits his frame well. Maybe even a couple more pounds would be great. It's not the size, it's what you do athletically. He's big, he's strong. He'll get stronger as he goes along and spends time in the weight room. But you can be too big. When you're too big, you don't have the endurance. You can't move. You can't regroup. You can't correct a mistake if a guy makes a move. But there's too much to move. There's too much body weight on you. So you have to be at a certain weight that where you can control your instincts. You can control your body. And you have the endurance to finish a game when it's fourth down on the one-yard line and it's in the fourth quarter or overtime. You want to run right behind him.
Did you have any players when you were at UNLV coach that came in like the 380 range and you got them down to 320-ish or something like that? Did you have anyone kind of freaky like that?
Well, we didn't have anybody at 380, but we did have some that needed to lose weight. And we had a training table, what we call a fat man's table. And it's not to disgrace them or to belittle them, but it's where the athletic trainer and a strength conditioning coach ate with them every day. And during camp and during the season, they had a special table that they ate at, and they were watched on every meal they had. And it just gave them a little bit of more of encouragement, not that they wouldn't cheat or take things they're not supposed to eat, but we made sure they ate all the proper foods they should eat so that they wouldn't lose their strength and conditioning along the way. But we had this table where they sat and they had to lose so much weight. And we would tell them, you have to lose 20 pounds or 15 pounds. And once they met that, then they'd go sit at another table with their guys who they wanted to sit with. But it's important that you have and you are conditioned. You got to look the part as well as play the part. And you've got to get yourself down where you can control the body weight that you have and you can play at that weight.
All right. We had a follow-up from Eric. And this is a question that I think you will like, Coach, because you like the running game. He said, also, with all the injuries at running back, do you think the Trojans have enough backs to run the ball consistently to prevent them from becoming a one-dimensional passing team?
I certainly do, and I think you have to run the football. You have to run the football. You can't change your philosophy. When they became a good football team last year, it was the second part of the season when they discovered, Curtis McNeil and how it improved not only their passing game, but the running game, they became a balanced football team. And they've got to keep their running game. And how many backs do they have? How many do you really need? There's only one ball. and you can only carry it, you know, Marcus Allen and the backs in the past carried the ball 30, 40 times a game. Well, I think that Curtis McNeil has that ability. He's not a physical back as far as a big back, but he's a tough back. He's tough to bring down. He's got a lot of heart. He always falls forward. I've never seen him get caught from behind. I think DJ Morgan can come in and spell Curtis. I think he's a different type of back. He's a strider. He's a glider. He's a speed guy. And I think that changes the tempo of the game. And he's a home run hitter. He did it in the spring game. He broke a long run in the spring game. He looked great doing that. So you've got backs that can come in. You got Allen, who's more of a slugger and a knock-you-out type of guy. And then you've got also Akbar or Aguilar coming in, that if you need to play him at tailback for a year, you can, because now if Justin comes, Davis, and also if Isaac comes, then in the next year you can move Aguilar back to receiver. But I certainly think you have enough. You know, you don't have great players always at one position, but you got to make sure those players understand what their role is, and they got to do it. They just got to do it. And sometimes they might have to play a little hurt. But if they do, you rest them during the week. You don't beat them up during the week. You rest them. You get them ready. You get them in the whirlpools. You do what's necessary so that on game day, you're a fit.
All right. Well, thanks for those questions, Eric. Let's go to a voicemail question from Bob. It's a little long. We'd like to, if you can, when you do your voicemail questions, like to keep the show flowing, you know, 30 seconds, 45 seconds, something like that. But I thought this was an interesting one, Coach, so I'm going to play it for you.
Good morning, Ryan. This is Bob Verdugo, Covina, California. I've been a USC Trojan fan since 1968 when I would sit on my dad's lap and watch the games. Anyhow, how you doing, Coach? Gerard and Dan, great show, fellas. But listen, the reason why I'm calling is simple. I'd like to see the 45th anniversary of the football game in 1970 that changed America, or specifically the South. I guess what I'm trying to say is back in the day, USC and Alabama played a historic game, and I'd like to see a home-and-home series between Alabama and USC revisited. The first game in Alabama, quite naturally, you'd have a week-long celebration of food and music. You could even have replica uniforms, you know, one-time usage, and there could even be a parade. It'd be a nice, wonderful opportunity to see college football where it was and where it currently is today. And obviously the game here at the Coliseum, basically you could have a golf tournament, again, one-time unis and helmets to be worn for the game only, a week-long celebration, and include all the, you know, past Samoan players, Latino players, even Asians, even foreign-born players that have all contributed to college football since 1970. And here at the Coliseum, I'd like to go one step farther and maybe even get Hollywood involved, where at the halftime show, if it's possible, that we could have a hologram imagery with the lights dimmed low of both coaches on both sidelines, of John McKay and Paul Bryant. I think that'd be great, be wonderful. And, you know, again, it's a celebration more than anything else of two great universities with two wonderful storied football programs. How do we make this happen? And fight on. Thank you.
Hey, Bob, thank you very much for your question. I like what you're saying. I really do think it's great. I think USC would be for it. I'm not quite sure Alabama would be for it. They like playing John Mason or Steve Mason or I don't know, Bob Oles University or something. Not to make fun of the University of Alabama, but I think it'd be a great, great traditional game. I think if I can remember properly, Mike Garrett told me at one time he tried to get a game with them. And don't take my word for it, but I think. And they declined. But I think it'd be great to play that type of game. I think it brings back the memories of John McKay and Bear Bryant. You know, they were the best of friends, those two guys. I remember going to clinics and they would both be speaking, and they were just idols to us young coaches, just idols. And the games were great, and we paid each other by playing there and playing in the Coliseum. It was great. I remember the one year that Bear Bryant came to the Coliseum and ran the wishbone, put the wishbone in and beat USC. And SC wasn't ready for it. The next year, USC went down to Alabama or whatever year it was and beat them down there. And Sam Cunningham, the story of Sam Cunningham integrating the South, is still talked about. I think it's a great rivalry. I'd love to see great games like that. I don't know if that'll ever come about, because teams are sometimes worried about, oh, if we lose a game, we won't be playing in the national championship and all of that. But I think that's what college football's about. I think you can't run and hide from competition. SC has never ran and hide from competition. I think Alabama has the type of recruiting classes now and the type of players that they don't need to run and hide any longer. I don't think Saban's the type of guy to hide behind something. I know they say they play a tough conference schedule, so they try to play lesser-level teams and preseason games, but I don't think you can do that anymore. I think you've got to get out there and you got to play. And I think that'd be an absolute great, great, great series between these two. It'd really mean a lot. In most cases, the way recruiting's going, it's Alabama and USC in recruiting. Alabama, of course, has more scholarships than USC, but USC will get through this and maybe someday, you know, you have to schedule these games 10 years in advance anyway, so it's down the road a ways. But I think, Bob, it'd be great. And as far as special events surrounding it, I think it'd be great. I like your idea about putting the coaches on the big video boards, going back in history, having special tributes to the players. I think that's all part of college football. You can't forget where college football came from. And I agree 100%. Will it happen? Maybe. Just depends if you know, Pat Hayden and their athletic director and both coaches agree to something like this. I know one thing. I know that Lane Kiffin tried to play Tennessee and they wouldn't play. I mean, that right, Ryan?
Yeah. Well, I think Bob felt that you had to pull Coach Hyde to make this happen yourself.
You had to do what?
That you had the pull. You had the clout, so you could make this game happen all on your own.
Oh, I could? Yeah. I'd love to be the promoter of it. I tell you what, the tickets would be tough to get. I'll tell you that. It'd be a great game. You know, a game like that could happen on a neutral field. I don't know, maybe a one-time shot like down, you know, how they have that opening game every year down in Arlington and Jerry Jones' stadium. I think this year, who is it? Michigan and who's playing that game?
I don't know. Oregon and LSU last year. I'm not sure who it is this year.
Yeah, I think it's Michigan and Alabama this year. Michigan, ooh. LSU. It would have to be one of those games, I think, if you want to get it on right away. But I know there's a big game there this year. Michigan, and maybe it is Alabama. I'm not quite sure. But it's a big one coming on.
Okay. Well, we'll look that up for you and then get to you by the end of the podcast. Let's go to Paul in Las Vegas. You know where that is, Coach. So he said, on game day and prep days, is Coach Kiffin, quote unquote, the man who can best prepare and execute the offense given our sophisticated plan and talented players? Or, and he says, and now I'm just thinking outside the box, would hiring an offensive genius like Bobby Petrino just to do planning and game calling be appropriate? That's again from Paul in Las Vegas.
Well, here's the way I feel. I think that Lane Kiffin, when Lane first came to USC, I really felt he should have an offensive coordinator. I felt that with the controversy going on, with all the sanctions, with all the media, all the attention given the program, I thought it was a big job for him to call the plays and tend to all the things that were going on. I really did. But now after watching him the second year, which was last year, and his performance going 10-2, starting to see him now get into it where it looks as though he can do it. Normally you don't see this on the Division I level because a head coach is responsible for so many speaking engagements, post-game, pre-game, during the week interviews, radio shows, all of the different appearances you have to make, meetings with the athletic director, conference calls with the tournament, not the tournament, but with the conference. It's very difficult because it takes time away from your game planning itself. But I think Lane loves to do the play calling. And I think that it would be very difficult for him to stand back and allow someone else to call the plays. And when you call plays, you've got to have a flow and a rhythm, just like players playing every down. You've got to have a reason to call a play. You've got to know why the play didn't work the last time. You've got to change blocking schemes. You've got to really be into it. And I think that he's into it too much to give it up. I think he has his plan. He likes calling plays. And I think he won't give it up. And not that I don't think he should give it up. I'm just saying he enjoys it. Now, there becomes a time when you say, you know, I can't do it all. Recruiting, calling plays, doing the necessary things that have to do with this team. And you do then turn maybe the running game over to one coach and the passing game over to another coach, and you sort of coordinate what they come up with. But he likes it. And if he likes it, you got to let him do it, because he'll second-guess the guy that's doing it. I called plays when I was in junior college as a head coach. When I got to the four-year level, there were so many things to do that I hired people who I believed in who could call the game offensively and defensively. But I was in control of the game the whole time. I heard every play that was called offensively or defensively, and what I would tell the coordinators who was doing that, when we reach certain zones, you could pass on this down, you can't, or go for it, or I'm giving you two downs to get the first down. We're not going to kick a field goal, so you got two downs, get the first down, or all I want is three out of this series. Things so they could plan ahead. And the same thing with defense. Don't blitz. We've got them down there. I don't want to take a chance of a big play. Or go after them. We can't stop them. Go after them. Go after them 100%. Don't worry about it. Play man and go after them. It's the only way we're going to stop them. We got to get a sack. So that's the way I did it. And I think Coach Kiffin likes calling plays. He's not ready to give it up. So I think he should keep doing it.
All right. Yeah, we'll see what happens. It could be an offensive explosion this year, Coach. So I don't think people will be asking him to not be calling plays anymore if USC starts putting up 50 points a game or something with all those weapons Matt Barkley has at his disposal. Andy V is a first-time emailer. Thanks for emailing the show, Andy. And he wants to know, will one of the tight ends move to fullback and play what Red Ellison's role was this past season? Guys like Junior Pomme and Christian Thomas seem to be strong candidates for something like this.
Well, they certainly could. They could do that and use him as an H-back. I think it's good to have big receivers in the game where you cause mismatches. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if that happens. I just think that you've got to get your tight ends on the field. You really do. You've got to get those type of players playing. You can't waste their eligibility. New England did it with two great tight ends, and look what they did. You caused mismatches, corner routes, drag routes, deep corner routes. You can do so much with two big tight ends. Yet you have great receivers outside, too. You could take a great running back like Farmer, except, you know, you could use him in a different role as far as a running back and as far as a receiver, too. You could take this kid Agar coming in. He's the type of kid that could do that. But I think you'd be more apt to take a Palmer, who's a great athlete, put him in that type of position, and teach him the same role that Ellison had. You really could. It just depends what you want to do with your offense. You don't want to have tendencies with your offense. You can't just put a guy in uncertain plays. As a defense, it gives a signal to the defense. These are the things they do out of this set. So you've got to keep a person in a position all the time, and you've got to move them around and do all the different things that you normally do. Otherwise, you give field tendencies, formation tendencies, down distance situation tendencies, and that's the worst thing you can do today with computers, because defensive coaches call their game plan on what your tendencies are if they can find out what they are, personnel-wise or play-wise, formation-wise, or whatever. So, yeah, I think they'll look at that. I think they should look at that, and they probably will.
And Andy, too, I think a lot of it depends on what Sima Vanuku does. If he can play the Stanley Havili role, I think Lane Kiffin won't have any problem really just rolling with him as a one fullback guy for most of the year. And they could move a scholarship guy, like you said, that we saw with Red Ellison, and it worked out okay for him. He still ended up getting drafted. Or they'd move a guy over just to play a particular role, like when they moved Ross Cumming from linebacker. So you might see one of the walk-ons that's contributing jump in there as well. So there's definitely some options, but I think at least, Coach, if Sima Vanuku starts, you know, really excelling in that role, they'll probably just roll with him the whole season.
I agree with you. If he can play like he did in the spring, he showed me a lot in the spring game. He really did. I didn't know he had it in him. He's faster than what I thought he is. He had better hands than I thought he had. He ran hard. He was hard to tackle. I thought he had a great spring, and he had a great spring game. So I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they go with him in that role. I was really impressed by him in the spring game.
All right, yeah, I was as well, so we'll see. Wearing that number 31, too, so he looks kind of like Havili. Andrew, we got a couple more we'll get to, and we'll let you go, Coach. Andrew said, is number 5 unofficially retired at USC? He's talking about Reggie Bush's number.
I don't know if it is. I really can't say. I know that SC gave up everything else. I mean, the Heisman Trophy, and they sent back, and whatever else it was attached to Reggie Bush. I don't know if they've retired it. I know no one's worn it. You told me that earlier when we talked about it. I think that if someone wears it, it'll bring up the Reggie Bush conversation, and people will write about it and talk about it again. I think most people want to forget that situation. I think people want to move on. I know I definitely want to move on. So I think that number 5 is something that if it isn't retired, they don't want to retire it, because people will write about that. I can just see everybody talking about, oh, can you retire this number? And if someone wears it, I know people will say, why are you wearing that number? That's bad. You know, it brought bad feelings to the university. We went on sanctions, probation, all this stuff. So I think they're just better off doing what they're doing, just leaving it alone and move on. And if you have to wear it because you run out of numbers, just give somebody a double number. I think really that's probably what they're thinking. Now, are they? Do I know they're thinking that? I have no idea. I just a guess.
Yeah, and I think unofficially retired is probably a good way to do it, because USC does only retire the numbers of, and we've talked about this, I think, last week on the podcast, you know, Heisman Trophy winners. I think that's something USC could still control if they want to say, we retired that number because of Reggie Bush's career and he was awarded the Heisman and, you know, gave it back. I'm not sure. Well, I don't. We can try to find out, though, for that, about if it's really, like, officially retired, or did they take that away just like they took away all the Reggie Bush memorabilia and things like that. The thing, if it is, I would guess it's unofficially retired, like Andrew's saying, but here's how it can become unofficially retired. There's a 5-star running back recruit, you know, in Southern California somewhere, and he wore number 5 his whole career and wanted to come to USC, wear number 5. And I think if, you know, Lane Kiffin's a shrewd recruiter, and if he knows it's going to help him land this player, and he's a, you know, the best running back prospect you've seen in years, and he wants to wear number 5, I would think, Coach, he would probably be able to wear number 5.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. So you'd say, I can understand the saying, no, we don't want to bring that up, but if it's a way to get, I mean, they let Darnell Bing wear number 20, Mike Garrett's old number, and that was retired. So, I mean, I think if they really wanted a kid, that pulling a number out of retirement, or you know, letting someone wear it, I don't think it's out of the question.
Well, nothing's out of the question, but I would try to discourage a kid to wear that number, just because I wouldn't want him to be always compared to Reggie Bush. Reggie was a great athlete now. And I think right now, if someone was to ask that right now in the situation, and down the road, let's say down the road, when things are forgotten and USC goes to the Rose Bowl and USC wins the national championship and all the things that all the Trojan fans want to see happen, things are forgotten. And then number 5, no one will even notice it unless somebody writes an article on it, which they will. I mean, there's always somebody out there that notices that stuff and looks for that stuff, and they'll make a big to-do on it. But it'll be a one-time article, and you move on. But, you know, if I was put in that position, and as far as getting a kid that he's got to be pretty good now, Ryan.
Oh yeah, no.
I tell you, he's got to be pretty good, okay? And Pat Hayden's got to agree to it too. Then probably they'd do it.
Yeah, we'll see. Who knows? The recruiting world is crazy. They pull out some interesting ideas, I guess, when you're trying to land special recruits, and especially right now with USC down, 10 scholarships a year. So we'll see. But so far, the recruiting season is going well. We'll talk about that with Gerard Martinez a little bit later on the week. We'll do a recruiting show on that. But, Coach, thanks again for coming on and sharing a little piece of your Memorial Day. I know you want to get back out to the sun and do whatever you do as the unofficial mayor of Avalon over there on Catalina Island. So I'm sure your subjects are out there waiting for you. And thanks again for coming on the show.
Well, thank you very much, Ryan, and thank you very much for having a show today. I really enjoyed doing it. We want to thank all of our listeners out there for coming on in and listening to USCFootball.com. And everyone out there, have a safe day if you're listening today on Monday. If not, we'll look forward to being with you next week.
All right. Thanks again, Coach, and everyone else. Back in 30 seconds, we're going to talk to USCFootball.com beat writer Dan Weber.
Meet us on the other side of the break for more of the Peristyle Podcast. Tickets, tickets, tickets. SC Tickets is your concert, sports, and theater ticket source. We have the tickets you need to any event worldwide. Football tickets are now available. Call SC Tickets now at 1-800-888-7287. 1-800-888-7287. That's 1-800-888-7287. Or visit us on the web at sctickets.com. SC Tickets, concerts, sports, and theater.
We now return to the Peristyle Podcast and your host, Ryan Abraham.
We are back here on the Peristyle Podcast, and as promised, USCFootball.com beat writer Dan Weber is joining us on this Memorial Day. Happy Memorial Day to you, Dan.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Glad to be able to stop by and say hi to everybody.
Yeah. It's a great day to remember the fallen troops and people that gave their lives for this country. And talked to Coach Hyde in the first segment, and we're like, it's a holiday. Should we do the show? But we got to get out on it. We got to do it. We got a lot of questions. People want to talk about Trojan football, but we also want to, say a special thank you to everyone that gave their lives for this country.
You always think if you ever have a chance to go out to the USC-UCLA baseball series at the end of the last one of the year, typically, and if it is Memorial Day weekend, you can go to the cemetery, LA, Veteran Cemetery, right across the way from Jackie Robinson Field there, and it's a very moving experience. I know I did that last year, going over there, and you really want to do something like that if you get a chance. It's just something special on this weekend.
It certainly is, and let's jump in there. That's actually a great point. That's been over there a couple of times, and it's definitely sombering, but it's worth going over and checking out. We got a bunch of questions, so we'll try to get through all of them. Theo wrote in, Dan, and he says, "What are your thoughts on switching Kevin Green to part-time linebacker, especially when playing smash mouth teams such as Stanford or Alabama?" Alabama's not on the schedule. I guess he's assuming USC might meet Alabama in the national championship game. Oh, and one other thing before we get into that, Dan, we talked to Coach Harvey Hyde in the last segment. He couldn't remember who Michigan was playing that first game of the season. It is Alabama, so Michigan play Alabama. Yeah, okay.
Kevin, that may not strength and hard work and all of those things are his strong suit. Movement, hip movement, for example, and all of that might not lend itself to linebacker. I wouldn't think. I mean, if he had the and some of that is a factor of starting football pretty late and being as big as he is and strong and all of that. But if he had the ability to step in at linebacker, he'd be an absolute killer defensive end at his size and strength and as hard as he works and all that. I'm just not sure that matches his skill set. As much as you'd like to have that size and strength there, the movement and the way they're going to play linebackers with the ability to move and all that, and just I think he'd have a better chance at moving down to a defensive tackle than he would as moving up to a linebacker would be my take on his physical skills.
All right. Thanks for that one, Theo. I agree with you 100% on that one, Dan. A lot of ability. Just hasn't been playing football that long. And I'm curious to see what he ends up doing this year because I think they're going to ask him to do more than we've seen before.
Yeah, and if he's the kind of kid, if he gets better and better and better and, improves on, you consider, maybe fifth year of football right now, who knows what the top end is for him. As smart as he is and as hard as he works and as strong as he is, all the other things, he's just hard to say where Kevin's going to end up, but would love to see. He just couldn't be a better kid.
Let's move on to Robert. We got an international question. He says, I'm a Trojan fan living in Honduras. Cool. I'll actually be heading down next week to Belize. We're going for our year anniversary, Dan. So we won't have a show. Next week. So I'm going down sort of that neck of the woods. But he's a Trojan fan living in Honduras. I've been a listener since the beginning. It's awesome how long it's been going. He wants to know which pro quarterbacks, do you think Max Wittick and Cody Kessler resemble the most?
You know, I've always said with Cody that he looks like, Drew Brees, kind of, you know, that same kind of a guy with, escapability and ability to move on the run and improvise and a very catchable ball, not somebody you think of as having this, you know, cannon and all that, but certainly good enough. I mean, that's an easy comparison, I think. That just jumps out at you. Max Wittick, that's an interesting Let's see about that. That's because we haven't. Max has been this sort of typical, you know, big, strong Orange County guy with a big arm. But that's an interesting one. I would say a little bit of a maybe slightly smaller, you know, kind of a Carson Palmer guy. Maybe no one is going to come along with quite the arm, you know, the Carson head. I think his ability to run the ball, we've seen more and more of that, and that was always the thing about Carson that people didn't realize, that he ran, you know, in the 4.6, 40 area, and people just didn't understand, I think, how athletic Carson was. But that would be... That would be, you know, somebody I'd look at. I'll throw that to you.
It's interesting. I'm trying to think of who, you know, it's hard when you haven't really seen him in game situations. You're talking about, you know, kind of in a high school deal. You know, we got to see him play in high school and things like that. But, you know, now you're watching him just kind of on the practice field. It's tough to say. I think the one with Kessler, I agree with you on Drew Brees. I think it's a little tougher with Wittick. He's not like a, he's not, you know, 6'6 or anything like that. But, you know, kind of maybe a little bit of shorter but athletic and stronger armed guy. I'm trying to think of who that would be.
Yeah, and we haven't really gotten a scene where it's like his team and he gets to take over and take off when he, you know, wants, you know, when he has to or whatever. So we haven't maybe gotten a chance. Kessler has the ability more. I think when you're learning the offense and that, if you're the improvisational sort of a guy like Kessler is sort of naturally, it's easier to show that than maybe it is if your game is more like Max Wittick. So I'm not sure that we've really gotten a chance to maybe see him. And I think Lane has pretty much said the same thing, that we haven't really seen where his game can go. So it's something to think about, you know, and it's something for him to, you know, kind of show. Where can his game take him? He's certainly gotten better and certainly gotten more comfortable, you know, with the playbook and with, you know, being in the huddle and all that kind of stuff. So I think we'll see some things this year that'll give us a little more of an answer to that question. But he certainly looks like an awful lot of guys that you see in the NFL. I mean, it just, you know, he's kind of the classic-looking, you know, NFL quarterback with the classic kind of looking at NFL arm and probably better feet and legs than that maybe we give him credit for. We know he's got them. If you remember the his high school all-star game and that, he did an awful lot.
Yeah.
You know, with his feet and moving around and running the ball. And he did, you know, at modern day. It's just those kinds of kids with that kind of arm don't always get credit, you know, maybe for having those kind of feet.
What about, like, not the personality, but Mark Sanchez, like, physically?
See, I think Wittick is more the classic thrower. Mark, to me, always was the looked like he, if he would have, you know, been one of those two sport guys and played on the, you know, and competed for the track team, he'd have been a javelin thrower. You know, he was one of those guys that just tried to throw the ball through people, you know, where he just, and he got a lot of extension, but he kind of hit a sort of a low release point. Whereas Wittick's got that more stand-up, classic stand-up quarterback, throw the ball above your head, that kind of thing. Whereas Mark was that kind of real athletic, you know, get that real wide base as he, you know, turned the ball loose and just drilled it, you know, really got to kind of a, had a wide stance, for example, and had good escapability. Whereas Whittick is more that, looks like more the traditional kind of more upright quarterback, whereas Mark was kind of this, you know, hybrid sort of a guy. But I always thought of him as, you know, I'd like to see him throw a javelin because he had that kind of explosiveness and that ability to release the ball really wide base and kind of lower. Whereas Whittick's, I think, his ability to, you know, throw the ball over the top more.
Okay. Fair points there. Let's see. Let's go on to Paul and Petaluma. He says, other than early enrollees like Chad Wheeler, Wilson, and Starr, are you aware of any other freshmen who are enrolled in the first summer school session? And then any information or rumors about incoming athletes who still may have academic hurdles to clear? I do know that Max Turek is enrolled. So he was already enrolled in that first summer session. So I think it's any of the guys that graduated high school, not early, but like they were a little bit early. Sometimes, you know, and sometimes graduate in June. The other guys are early May. Those guys could enroll. So I know of Max Turek already being on campus, but I'm not aware of anyone else. I don't know if you are, Dan.
No, I'm not. And it almost, you know, isn't a big deal anymore because you know they're going to be enrolled for one of the two, you know, summer sessions. And with the, all the, you know, kind of the regular guys being enrolled pretty much unless they've got, you know, they finished all their you know, things that they need in the summer, pretty much being enrolled for both summer sessions. You don't think about it as much anymore as to who's there and who's not. But I guess we'll certainly know when we see the first guys that show up for the summer workouts, the kind of voluntary throwing workouts and that, and then we'll have a better idea. But I think basically everybody will be there unless they've got an academic, and we really haven't heard much about that much in terms of high school guys that, you know, signees that are have academic issues still hanging over them. But that's the only thing I think that, you know, keeps the kid maybe from getting here at least by the second summer session. So, but it's certainly something to look at. It's not something they talk about very much, but you can kind of figure it out as it goes along.
Yeah, reading between the lines a little bit, and we'll figure it out. So let's go to Roger. He said he has a question on George Farmer. Have you seen any indication he's making real headway in his academic challenges so far? What is your opinion or knowledge in respect to his health issues? And do you have any opinions on whether you can expect some real progress from him as far as seeing him on the field?
Well, I actually talked to him about both of those things. He was, I think, kind of embarrassed about academic probation and just said, man, you know, that'll never happen again. I don't know how that happened, but that's not a problem. And he was, you know, during the, you know, second semester was, don't even, you know, it's not even worth worried about, you know, I'm taking care of that. I know what I didn't get done, didn't understand how to do some things. And he said, certainly that's all taken care of. Physically, toward the end, I think he got very serious about not being able to participate in spring football. And I think he talked about all the things he has to really understand about his body and about, you know, loosening up. And, you know, and it wasn't that he wasn't trying. I mean, if you would go by before practice, he was the last guy getting that massage and rub down and loosening up on the tables between Cromwell and Howard Jones, and it still might not have been enough. You know, when you've got a really heavily muscled, you know, dash man, you know, it's the same thing that all those guys in the Olympics and all those guys at the NCAA, you know, championships and that have to deal with, and a lot of the USC track kids do as well, is you just got to know your own body in ways in which maybe the more limber, lightly muscled guys don't have to think about. You just got more to pull. And I thought it was interesting that the two most muscular and guys with real speed, Buck Allen and George, were the two that really had issues. They were also the guys that ran the fastest 40s in the Actually, they kind of ran them in the winter, but or before they really got in the spring. You know, it's an issue. It's one of the reasons I think some teams don't run 40s all the time, because they don't want to take that chance of kids just putting that little extra into it. But I think by the end of the spring, when you talk to George, I think there was a focus about both of those aspects that you hadn't seen before. And it's hard. If you're as talented a young athlete as he's been, and not to say things come easy, you still got to really work hard at it, Matt. But you're not pushing yourself in a way that he has to pretty much every day at this point. And I think he's learning what it means to, you know, compete at the level he's competing at USC. And, you know, there comes a time when you sort of get it. And I think that possibly happened to George in both aspects in the spring semester. So I'm fairly encouraged about him. He's got some great role models, to say the least. If you just limit those role models to Sarah High alum, he's got some great role models. So, but he's coming from a different place. He's got a different set of physical tools and has done it differently over his career. So that'd be an interesting thing to watch, is how does George deal. It's not always easy. You know, you look at some of the great athletes that have come into USC in the last 10 or 12 years, and it's not always been easy for them to figure out how to use all those athletic gifts. So certainly something to watch, and those are excellent questions.
All right. Let's move on to Donald in Florida. He's USC class of 1990. So this was about the Haiti trip, Dan, and you wrote some really great stuff about that, about the USC football player, 16 of them going down to Haiti. But this, I thought this was an interesting question. He says, now while I'm trying not to let my cynical side affect me too much, I do wonder about NCAA repercussions. I can just imagine the NCAA saying that the cost of the trip was an improper benefit and the sponsors given violate the amateur status of the players, i.e. the Colorado skier a few years ago in the Olympics. I'm sure the USC compliance department cleared it 100%, so I was wondering if you can explain what needed to be done. Was there any NCAA issues with the USC players going to Haiti, Dan?
Well, I know there was a lot of work and a lot of back and forth between USC and the NCAA, and a whole lot of things that had to be made very clear in terms of, like airfare. Okay, who's paying for it and exactly how they're paying for it, or kids going out to get sponsors and, to underwrite the trip and things like that. And I think, I think there was probably much, much, much more back and forth between USC and the NCAA than we can probably imagine, or that USC, Les Barkley, who really was the inspiration and the Barkley family, and they've done this themselves a number of times, and they thought, they extended the opportunity to, these USC players all of a sudden changes everything in terms of how the NCAA looks at it. And I just don't think they probably wanted to focus all that much on the back and forth and the fact that they, had to change at kind of the last minute when they were going, based on, when summer school started and all that. So I think there was a lot of it, and I think they pretty much cleared everything. Now, I know if you want to be super cynical, you can say, yeah, well, the NCAA cleared O.J., Mayo before he got here, too, and says, yeah, he's fine. And then all of a sudden, that didn't seem to apply anymore. So, yeah, you can be cynical about the NCAA, and the NCAA deserves people to be cynical about them, without any doubt. But I think USC, did everything humanly possible to make sure that this was exactly as advertised. And it's obviously to think, oh, this is an extra benefit. It just... They couldn't even begin to try to, say that that wasn't the case. The NCAA's got enough credibility issues right now to not want to go there, you wouldn't think. I mean, I don't want to be cynical either, but I'm reading stories this last week about Michigan's football players who came out to Pasadena and worked out with the Navy SEALs, and I think 22 of the, you know, football players. And I know it was hard work, it was training and all that, but that one looked like it might be a little more closely related to football development and a nice trip to the West Coast. And I don't want to be cynical here, because you certainly want to give the Navy SEALs their due, and I'm glad the University of Michigan gave them their due, and Brady Hoke, you know, coached at San Diego State and all that. That, to me, looks like the kind of trip you'd have to spend even more time with the NCAA, making sure they understood this wasn't just, you know, a nice trip to the West Coast where you got some work in for the benefit of the players. So I would think USC doesn't have a lot of problem there.
All right. Thanks for that one. Let's see. That was from Donald, class of 1990. Let's go to Chuck in Florida. We need our weekly walk-on question, Dan. We always have these. He basically wants to know, what's a walk-on and how does their eligibility work? Just kind of explaining where they don't. A lot of times people get confused, Dan, if the walk-ons are counting towards scholarships, and obviously they don't. But how do they work as far as if you, you know, do you get 4 years, 5 years, a redshirt year, all that kind of stuff? The walk-ons get the same sort of eligibility time limits that scholarship players get.
Yeah, I think they absolutely do. And I think the big difference is, you know, was a walk-on recruited in the same way, you know, that the other athletes are? Obviously, they also don't get a scholarship. They don't, you know, get the benefit from the training table and things like that. But you do have the preferred walk-ons where they, you know, do give you help in terms of, you know, getting into school. You don't have to try out, things like that. Essentially, I think all of the, you know, the redshirt issues and all the other eligibility issues are exactly the same. For example, I think Zach Kuzner, who transferred in from San Diego State and has gotten his degree, and he had a couple of lingering, he started out as a quarterback at San Diego State and then a baseball pitcher and you know, damaged his arm. And then he got really, you know, he's at like 265 pounds now. And he's a terrific practice player for USC, got in some games last year. And I know he's requested now the extra year of eligibility. His eligibility ran out at the end of the spring semester, and he was practicing in the spring. And now he's requested it, you know, because of injuries and after his transfer from San Diego State for, you know, the medical redshirt year. So we'll see if he gets it. He would be a real plus to have a smart veteran kid, you know, just a great leader on the practice field out with USC. But the whether he was a scholarship player or not, all the eligibility issues are exactly the same.
Okay, thanks for that one, Chuck. And we got one last one, Dan, from Troy 75. He says, I fully agree with the points raised last week about USC needing a women's softball team. However, at the same time, I have to say that a men's soccer team is way overdue. I've heard rumors that the sports arena might be replaced by a purpose-built soccer stadium seating 25 to 30,000. What does SC have to do to overcome Title IX objections to having another men's team?
A great question. I don't know how they overcome that. I mean, there is that comparability issue. Where would they? Because they'd have to come up with at least one more sport if they added men's soccer to balance out, you know, the women's numbers. And I'm not sure what other opportunities they would have to balance out. I mean, I think it's easier when you've got the 28 or 30 sports or whatever that a Stanford has, but when you're under 20, like USC has, that makes it harder because any one new team added for the men throws you, you know, farther out of kilter in terms of, you know, total numbers. So that's a really good question, and you're right. Men's soccer, you know, is overdue at USC, and you wish you could balance out men's soccer and women's softball, balance out scholarship wise, probably number of bodies on the team, probably not. You'd have more on the soccer team, you would think, than on the women's team. And it's one of the issues, I will say this, it's where regulations like Title IX go wrong. For example, players or athletes that often get penalized under Title IX, for example, are walk-on football players. Because, and study after study has shown this, that it's far more likely, far easier for you, a college, to get men to walk on in their sports than it is for women. It's just one of those things that's different. Women aren't as maybe interested in being walk-ons as men are. So what happens is, in order to make them comparable, they have to knock off the number of walk-ons, for example, that they can allow in football, because they can't find enough walk-ons for the women's teams. And, you know, you can say, hey, Title IX was, was well-intentioned and all that, but there are some specifics in terms of essentially unintended consequences from a law like Title IX that really, I mean, I was covering Purdue one year, and we had a kid from our local high school, was a sports editor at the Post Tribune in Northwest Indiana. We had a kid who had become just like the best cover guy on the Purdue football team. And walk-on kid, loved football, is his life. And he got, after, like, I think his junior year, he basically was told that the way the scholarships numbers worked out and what have you, that they couldn't have any more walk-ons. And he lost, I mean, he didn't need a scholarship, didn't want a scholarship, and was told, our numbers are out of whack, and we have to cut, you know, the walk-ons at this number. And here's a kid who had started on every kickoff for 2 years and lost his ability just to be on the team because they were gonna, was going to throw the, because Purdue was a place where they had a lot of kids that wanted to walk on.
Jeez.
On the men's teams. So, I was, you know, I'm kind of soured on the way they figure out the numbers, but that's why now I think 105 is the number for men's football pretty much everywhere. I think that is the number. They have a number now. They used to not have one, but comparability makes it tough in terms of adding sports to make sure you keep that balance going.
I read an interesting article over the weekend. I cannot remember it. Man, I wish I remember who wrote it. But it was kind of a calling out of, people blame Title IX quite a bit when you're talking about these things. And that, you know, when you talk about baseball and you're seeing like USC baseball team struggling the last several years, and they have, I think it's 11.7 scholarships to hand out. The 11.7, like, that doesn't come from Title IX. That comes from the NCAA. And there's really weird limits of, like, why do some sports allow partials and why do some not? And it's like they're trying to keep everything in balance. But even on the women's side of sports, where, like, there's some sports that are fully, you can have the whole bunch of people on crew scholarships, and they were, you know, and if you have equestrian, like, there's these certain sports that have high numbers of scholarships, and it does seem to have to do with how much money. You know, it was almost like, well, the NCAA can make more money on this sport, so there can be more scholarships here. It put a lot of blame on the NCAA as opposed to Title IX, because Title IX doesn't say that, you know, you can only have 11 and a half scholarships for men's baseball. That's coming from the NCAA. So it was a really interesting article. I'll try to find it out for you and post it.
And I also would like to blame the universities, the conferences, lawyers in general, basically, because a lot of that is precedent-driven. Because, you know, people take them to court, and then they say, oh, we don't want to keep defending these cases, therefore, the Department of Education, in terms of how they look at things and all that. I mean, it's a big bureaucratic, you know, to some extent, I think, bureaucratic boondoggle in terms of how it's administered. And I think a lot of it is just to say, this will keep us out of court. Nobody can sue us if we do this. We'll be safe and all that. I would like to add one thing. I keep seeing on the P that everybody who says USC can go back to where it was in baseball and that the number of scholarships isn't a limitation on a private school, and they cite Rice, they cite Vanderbilt, they cite, Stanford, for example. And none of those schools are in the same situation USC's in. I mean, they really aren't, and people have to admit that. USC is surrounded by all of these great college baseball programs, you know, from a private school like Pepperdine to, you know, Cal State Long Beach and Cal State Fullerton and UC Irvine. There's other schools that are in areas, in metropolitan areas mostly, where they don't have the same kind of competition. And essentially, kids who play baseball in college, it's the highest number of athletes at in a particular sport who think they're going to play at the professional level. Baseball players, they go to college, but they go to college in order to play professional baseball. And you can get prepared just as well at UC Irvine or Cal State Fullerton or Cal State Long Beach for the major leagues as you can at USC. USC has no advantage. If you're a kid growing up in Central Tennessee, you are much better prepared for the major leagues if you go to Vanderbilt than if you go to David Lipscomb, for example. Those schools, or if you go to Rice, you're much better prepared for the major leagues than if you go to Houston even. It's not comparable, and people ought to throw that out of their minds. USC has a unique challenge because of all the great college baseball programs in Southern California. It's one of a kind. And to say, because Stanford does it, where else are you going to go in Northern California if you want to play on the best baseball, other than Cal, obviously, but they've got two. And there's so many more in Southern California. It's really difficult. I mean, UC Riverside got a good program. I mean, there are just so many good programs where you can get just as prepared for the major leagues as you can at USC. So, and the difference with USC and softball, if USC started softball, girls are not going to college to play softball, to play pro softball. They're going to college to get a good degree. So USC has an advantage there. So if they start softball, there's an advantage. If I walk in recruiting you and I'm at USC, I've got a better shot at you than if I'm at Long Beach or Fullerton because of USC. That same advantage goes away completely when you're talking about men and baseball. I just wanted to get that on the table because it's really different. And USC, it, just getting the right coach, sure, that'll help and a lot of other things. But USC has a unique challenge in baseball. Obviously, it has the greatest tradition in college baseball historically. That makes it even more of a challenge, I think, in some ways. So just wanted to throw that out there, even though it's maybe not football related. I've seen enough, you know, posts recently, you know, when they look at this baseball season and USC finishes, you know, second from the bottom in the Pac-12, and so, you know, USC should be able to get back to the top. Until they get enough scholarships so that you can have a real baseball team, the scholarships, for example, in softball are much closer. You can have the same pitcher pretty much all year long.
Yeah.
Might have to have one backup. College baseball, you need, you know, six pitchers. It's a whole different animal, and it's not that comparable. And it's a gigantic challenge, you know, for USC. And I'm not sure, you know, what the good answer is, considering all those other great programs in Southern California. It's a very difficult issue.
Excellent points, Dan. Well, thanks again for coming on the show and sharing some time on this Memorial Day. And I just want to remind people, next week I will be out of the country. We'll be on secret assignment, as Coach Harvey Hyde likes to say. So we will not have a Peristyle podcast. It's my year anniversary with my wife, and we're going to be gone for a little while. But I will try to do a recruiting blast show probably on Wednesday of this week. Gerard has been really under the weather and is not feeling good at all. But I did the show myself last week. Hopefully he'll be better, and we can do the show together. If not, I'll just answer your questions myself on that Wednesday. And then I'll be gone for about a week, and we'll come back in 2 weeks and do the regular Peristyle podcast again. But thanks again, Dan, for coming on.
Thank you, Ron. And hang in there. If you do it all by yourself, heck of a job.
Thanks. Okay. We're going to have you come on, too. All right. Take care, Dan. Thanks. Everyone else, thank you very much for tuning into the Peristyle podcast. We'll see you on Wednesday for the Trojan Blast, and then a week and a half after that, we'll be back with the regular podcast.
G.
You've been listening to the Peristyle Podcast, presented by USCFootball.com. Be sure to tune in next week for the latest news on Trojan football and recruiting. And don't forget, you can automatically download the podcast directly to your iPod or MP3 player for free. Just click the iTunes link on peristylepodcast.com or search for Peristyle Podcast at the iTunes Music Store.